don't want any more economists, sages, or oracles bombinating over our cables. I want a reporter.
What are your goals here at WNYX?
Well, I just want to be the best damn news director I can be.
Great Caesar's ghost! What gives you the idea that a young whippersnapper like Olson can run the most important paper in Metropolis?
What's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
There's nothing you can do about the press. It's the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Steve Scherr. Thank you for joining us. Thanks for helping us reach our pledge drive goal.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. See, that's what Bernard was excited about. Knut Berger is here. He writes the Mossback column at crosscut.com. He blogs at Seattle Magazine. He has scads of books at his house, and he's written a few. Pugetopoulos, good to see you again.
Good to see you, Steve.
Eli Sanders, associate editor of The Stranger. You also have scads of notes at your house because you're writing a book.
That's true.
Yeah, scads of notes, I bet.
Buried in them.
And Essex Porter is here, senior political reporter for Cairo 7 News, who has scads of probably old VHS tapes, right?
You know, I just dumped a whole thing of those, and my wife is probably hearing that for the first time. But I have scads of unread books at my house.
Yeah, I have a lot of those, too. All right, thank you guys for being here. And our friend Joni is off somewhere. Let's start with Tom Foley a little bit, because we were reminiscing before we started. So, Knut, how much did you ever get to cover Foley when he was in Congress?
Yes and no. I mean, I was
from distance.
I was editing the Weekly when he was right toward the end of his speakership, and I saw him speak a number of times. The memory I have of coverage was actually in the 1980s. I was doing a campaign story on John Spellman, who was on a tour of Eastern Washington, going to all the small town newspapers, doing interviews. We were following him through places like Tico and Palouse, and we arrived in Waitsburg, which is outside of Walla Walla, and it was one of the few places that had a Democrat who was editing the local newspaper. And one of the questions, I had a chance to talk to the editor. And then, you know, Waitsburg is like a town that, you know, you would expect to see Mark Twain or Huckleberry Finn in. It's just a very charming, interesting place. And in this old newspaper office. And I asked the guy, I said, you know, this area is so Republican. Why do you elect Tom Foley? And he said, well, he takes care of us. And he also said that he was known, that, you know, Tom Foley was somebody that everybody had met, could talk to. You know, he was, despite the fact that he was, you know, a kind of besuited power figure in Washington, D.C., you know, he had a lot of connections with the people in his district. But there was a mentality then, I think, where they realized that what he did for the district and what the federal government did for the district was really important when it came to growing wheat, when it came to infrastructure, when it came to policy, taxation, all of those issues. There wasn't this anti-government sense. There was a sense that we need somebody in Congress who understands our issues and will be responsive when we have a problem. And so it was a different era, but it just shed, I thought, some light from his constituents on what made Tom Foley so effective.
Essex, did you ever get to cover him? Were you reporting then?
I was reporting. He made numerous visits to Seattle. You know, I did some of the usual sort of quick interviews reporters do when big issues come up. And I was part of the reporting scrum the day that it was clear that he was going to be Speaker of the House. I remember the sort of gentle approachability, but also dignity with which he handled that situation. You know, especially because I believe at the time he was in Seattle actually to attend a very prominent funeral. And, you know, he knew there was news about that, but, you know, he didn't want anything to interrupt that funeral, and he handled it beautifully. I also visited Spokane when it became clear he was in trouble of not being reelected. Visited Spokane wandered around, talked, you know, did the random interviews of folks you meet. And the affection for him was very great in those just interviews with voters. But when you listened to the way they expressed that affection, it was clear that they decided that they wanted to change.
Yeah, he was the outsider at that point to Nethercutt. Nethercutt's insider? Is that who ran against?
Yeah, George Nethercutt, who ran, you know, was part of the Gingrich uprising and ran as a term limit, pro-term limits. There was kind of an inherent critique of the longevity that Foley had.
Right. That, and as we were reading today and what Austin was reporting, he had taken a stand against for a ban on assault weapons, and the NRA poured a lot of money into the race as punishment. Before that, he had been pretty staunch on gun control.
There was we actually did a cover of the Weekly that it enraged Foley and his people at that time. And it was a political cartoon cover that showed Foley kind of sinking into this mire in Washington. And the story was not about Foley, any corruption or anything about Foley, but he really took objected to this particular image. But the point that the story made, and this is, you know, a liberal Democratic newspaper, was that when Foley became Speaker and his love of the institution of the House took him away from his district to some degree, that there became a disconnect. And whether that was fair or not, he was seen as the personification of an institution that Americans were falling, had no affection for.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was a sense that he was kind of increasingly involved in the inner workings of the House and not the inner workings of his district. And I think that led to that sense that Essex was talking about, where the voters were feeling it was time for a change. Yeah. Same thing happened with Magnuson, and in terms of
more
being there
Senator,
so long that people went for the change.
Well, remember, people had expected that Bill Clinton's election would bring, you know, a bit of a revolution to Washington, D.C. And Bill, there was no revolution. Folks of the conventional leadership mold, like Tom Foley, embraced President Clinton. And you know, that's part of what ultimately hurt President Clinton, was the fact that there wasn't the huge change that people had expected. And, by the time it came time for that election, 94 it was, people were looking for that change, and they were going to try to get it.
Yeah. You as a young whippersnapper, you were just admiring him as you were a proto-journalist at that point, right, Eli?
Well, Tom Foley's last year as Speaker was 1995. That's the year I graduated from Garfield High School.
Yes.
So I was not very aware of him. But in reading about him and hearing Austin's report about him, I find it very interesting in terms of a contrast to the person who currently holds his seat, Kathy McMorris Rodgers. I mean, just looking at the last 3 weeks and how McMorris Rodgers behaved in her attitude toward government, and the way apparently she feels it now fits with her district, suggests the incredible change that's taken place not only among the voters out there, but among Republicans over this period. Foley obviously wasn't a Republican, but you could actually say the incredible change that's taken place in politics, where people feel it's advantageous to run against the institutions rather than improve them, that they feel it's more profitable to them in terms of political gain to tear it down rather than to build it up and work within the system to improve it, which is what Foley was, it sounds like, a person who did that.
I remember it was hard to interview Foley once he was Speaker, but he was here in the 80s. I remember being able to talk to him once at our studios. And I also met him when he was ambassador to Japan in Tokyo. And we talked a little bit about, we talked a little bit about Washington State, just that, you know, the good old Washington State. He was a remarkably tall fellow.
6'3",
yeah.
Red.
Well, I think Eli makes a great point, which is that it's easy to look back at some of the political figures of the past and turn them into giants, but some of them actually were. Some of them were people of great integrity and accomplishment. And, Tom Foley, I think, was one of those. And I think it's also, I really think it's that kind of look in the mirror thing where, if you look back and you look at Magnuson and Jackson and Foley, all in office at the same time, Washington had a disproportionate amount of power in Washington and influence, but it was mostly used to really benefit the state, the state that we have, the modern state. And it was not about dismantling government and dismantling civil society. I think, the fact that Foley kind of lost out in the Gingrich Revolution, and now you've got the Boehner, whatever it is.
Boehner, McMorris, Rogers.
Boehner, McMorris, Rogers catastrophe. I think it just shows how far we've come, and it'd be great to get back to some of the ways we used to do things.
And what Knut was saying just now, and also something he said last week, reminded me of the incredible disconnect we see now between the perception of big government and the federal government in eastern Washington and the more conservative areas and what the federal government has done for eastern Washington, particularly under the leadership of people like Foley. And so that's just another marker of how much things have changed, that there is this kind of amnesia or willful ignorance about how much conservative districts like Kathy McMorris Rogers' district are dependent on work that the federal government did in that region over decades.
And Waitsburg, Washington, that's a great town.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's a beautiful town.
And it's kind of been discovered by the foodies and the brewers and all that. So it's got a whole different element.
If Tom Foley had come back, he had a place to go.
He could have had a great microbrew.
All right. Remembering Tom Foley on the Weekend Review. We'll take a break. We'll come back. Let's talk about the shutdown and the repercussions. This is KUOW.
48 degrees and foggy in Seattle. Expecting sun this afternoon with a high today of 61. Tonight, mostly clear with some fog after midnight, a low of 46. Tomorrow, a lot like today, but a little warmer. Morning fog, then sun in the afternoon with a high of 63.
This is the week where we figure out all the world's problems. Melinda Gates tries to make it more healthy. Erykah Badu tries to make the world more funky. And Jeff Bridges says, well, that's just your opinion, man. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for an intellectual roundtable on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR.
That's tomorrow morning during the 10 o'clock hour here on KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
KUOW and Balagun Theater present Carrie, the musical, starring Alice Ripley, based on the novel by Stephen King about an awkward teen outcast.
This is the Weekend Review.
Horrible gift. Now through October 26th at the Moore Theater. Learn more on the events page at kuow.org.
It's 10:20, KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
This is like the pledge drive. Still going on. We're just talking over each other. Bernard, I apologize. It's the Week in Review on KUOW. I'm Steve Scher. Essex Porter is here from Cairo TV. Eli Sanders is here from The Stranger. Knut Berger is here from Crosscut and Seattle Magazine. Let's take a look at what happened, because something else happened besides we ended the pledge drive. Apparently, the government was reopened. Here's Patty Murray talking to Ross Reynolds earlier this week.
There were some folks here who had to learn that taking hostage something, in this case Obamacare, and using it as leverage against our country's ability to pay its bills or to stay open was not a winning battle. And I hope that they put their knives back in their sheaths and allow us to do what everybody has expected us to do for a long time. Sit at a table, fight for what you believe in, but at the end of the day, compromise for the good of the whole country. And I hope that's a lesson that has been firmly implanted in many people's heads back here.
Senator Patty Murray, who, of course, I don't know what she's talking about, Essex, because she has to go now do a budget negotiations where I'm sure knives are going to be plunked right up on the table. What do you think? Will they be back and sheathed?
Well, there will certainly be knives on the table. You know, I listened to her speak yesterday with the co-chair in those negotiations, the House Republican budget leader.
Paul Ryan.
And, it certainly started out, as there's sort of a cautiously cordial approach. Neither one of them, and I remember this from Senator Murray, says, you know, I know that he's not going to vote for my budget, you know, I'm not going to vote for his. We have to find something there in the middle.
Yeah, she was thinking, though, that there was something there in the middle that they could find. And Paul Ryan, I guess he said the same thing. What do you think, Eli? Did you find some middle ground in what they were speaking about this week?
Well, you can go back to May of this year, and there was a profile of Patty Murray in the American Prospect that was very interesting. And at the end of it, it talked about budget negotiations she was in with Paul Ryan. And at that time, she said basically the same thing. We're not going to vote for each other's budgets, but hopefully we can compromise. But, and the place the article ended strongly suggested this, Republicans back in May might decide that it's more profitable to just shut down the government to try to give themselves additional leverage. And that's exactly what happened. And so the question again, even after this incredible catastrophe that hurt the Republican Party, cost the United States billions of dollars, left no one looking very good, even after all of that, the question remains whether Republicans will try it again, whether Ryan will himself go for compromise, or whether he might want to say, and he won't be given the green light to do that by the more radical members of his caucus in the House. And so they'll sit at the negotiating table, but like before, do nothing and wait for the leverage that they think might be created by bumping up again against financial calamity.
God, that would be so interesting. What do we have? January 15th for some sort of debt deal, and February 7th for another round of debt ceiling negotiations. Do you think the Republican Party feels stung by this? And that's the big party. I think
some of them do. I don't think it's Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate leader, said that, you know, it's a little bit like you don't learn much the second time you're kicked by a mule. You learned everything the first time when they should have learned, and, you know, when the Gingrich shutdown happened. And now they just get kicked. There's no lesson that comes from it except it hurts. And the, you know, one of the things that hurts is they saw, you know, the devastating poll numbers. They've given Democrats a real opening to make a case for 2014. I think some of that will also trickle down. We'll talk about this later, but trickle down to legislative races and state races. So I think there's been damage. But there's a segment of the Republican Party, the Ted Cruz wing of the party, that I think seeks to benefit from laying waste to the party and remaking it as a more conservative, more of an outsider party in some ways. And that's an internal fight. And I think McConnell has said that he won't shut the government down again, at least, you know, on his end. But he doesn't control,
yeah,
you know, the entire party. And I certainly think there are elements within the party that would still be willing to default, would still be willing to do a shutdown. I don't think they're repentant at all. Their fundraising is going off the charts. Ted Cruz is raising more money than he's ever raised before.
Is that right?
There is his PAC is doing really well. So one reaction of Republicans is that we went too far, but a big core, a grassroots core of the party thinks they didn't go far enough. Let's do more. And the way we do that is we transform the party. We take the party over.
So the Pew had Senator Ted Cruz's popularity soaring among Tea Party Republicans. Went from 47% to 74%. Do you smell a presidential run in there for Ted Cruz in 2016?
It's a long way off. There may be the start of a presidential run, but, you know, there are other analysis that you know, he's not saying the somewhat moderating things that can actually get you, you know, past enough primaries that that say a Marco Rubio is being, you know, far more careful about what he says and what he does, so that he can get past you know, more primaries, and then and with having gotten the nomination, have a real chance to win.
So here's President Obama. This was last night. President Obama was basically again speaking pretty harshly about what the Democrats had done. He said it was a spectacle that harmed the America's economy. What the Republicans had done, yes. Nothing has done more damage to America's credibility in the world, our standing with other countries. It's encouraged our enemies, emboldened our competitors, depressed our friends who look to us for steady leadership. So I guess we sort of see what the Republican strategy might be or the Tea Party strategy might be in the coming running up to the 2024 elections. But I've been thinking about this. What's a President Obama strategy against some of these specific Tea Party Republicans? What do you is this enough that he speaks from the high ground, or what would you have him do if you were
President Obama?
His campaign?
You've got to remember about President Obama. When he ran in 2008, people asked him what his favorite movie was. His favorite movie is The Godfather. And you'll remember Godfather 2. The senator asks for something, and he gets his answer right away. You get nothing. And what President Obama, I think, for him, what has worked for him this certainly in the last few weeks, and what he very well may continue is, you know, no more of this brinkmanship, hostage taking, gun to the head. We'll negotiate over stuff, but you know, if you're making threats, you get nothing.
Hmm. What do you? Yeah. And Godfather too.
And I think Obama.
I have an offer for you, John Boehner.
They keep having these private phone conversations. Maybe that's what happens.
Oh, yeah. Calls.
I think that
do you like horses?
Doesn't have to do anything different, really. He can do what he did over the last several weeks, which is outline his position, explain why it's in the best interest of the country for him not to compromise, and then wait and let the Republicans unmask themselves, in the case of the Tea Party wing, or fight among themselves. He is in a very strong position now and wins politically, no matter what happens.
But doesn't he run the risk of this because of the gerrymandered districts, that the same Tea Party members who have thwarted his efforts will again return to power?
Well, that was going to happen
anyway,
either way. And the possibility here is that they so enrage, as happened in the run-up to the debt ceiling, that they so enrage their financial backers on Wall Street or in the moneyed wing of the Republican Party that they get invested, as they've said they were going to do in the last couple of weeks, they get invested in removing some of these Tea Party Republicans. And that helps Obama ultimately. It could be good for the Republican Party, but it would be also very helpful for Obama's agenda.
You're agreeing. You see that as the way forward for the Republicans and for Obama?
Well, the only thing I would add is that it is true that the House is not likely to change because the districts are so polarized. But you know, there are Republicans in swing states as senators where you have to get the entire state to vote for you. If the Republican brand is simply damaged so badly because of the Tea Party intransigence, it gets more difficult for these senators to win. And those are the folks, even as you saw in this recent round of brinkmanship, who finally said, you know, enough is enough.
We've got a small example of potential change in Congress here in Washington State. Now, I don't know how likely this is, but Representative Reichert, Republican, moved to a more conservative district in the redistricting that we had here in Washington State recently. And he voted for the shutdown, but then because he styles himself as a moderate, he got fed up very quickly and voted to reopen the government. And now there's upset among some of the Koch brother-backed groups in D.C., including one called Americans for Limited Government, which sent out a press release yesterday slamming Reichert for voting for the shutdown and then voting to end the shutdown and basically saying he owns Obamacare and all the quote-unquote misery or whatever they said that comes from it. And that, to me, suggests that maybe we will have a Koch brothers-funded or a conservative group funded Tea Party challenger to Dave Reichert. Now, if you have that, you have Republicans bloodying each other in this district, which maybe creates an opening for a Democrat there, maybe a more moderate Democrat or more blue dog Democrat. And maybe there's an opening for a seat to flip.
Interesting. Yeah. Any final thoughts on the Democrats and what they do in the wake of this?
Well, I think in terms of
President Obama
Well, yeah, I mean, I think it has been a gift to the Democrats for 2014. It's given them something that they can fundraise on, that they can energize their own base on. It's put certain Republicans, as Eli says, on the record in ways that are going to be difficult to defend, or at least make them vulnerable to attacks on how extreme they are. And so in terms of the president, I mean, he's somebody who wants to negotiate in a very sort of civil way. I keep thinking of Lyndon Johnson, who was not particularly a civil negotiator, but in the Vietnam War, you remember him going on TV and saying, "Come, let us reason together." He was desperate to get a kind of conversation that going, and I think Obama has that kind of instinctively, but he doesn't have partners in that, and so I'm not sure he's going to get what he wants in terms of negotiating partners, but there's an opportunity, I think, for them to have an incentive to compromise some because of the damage that this has done, at least in the short term, to the Republican brand and the congressional brand.
I read an analysis that said that John Boehner had finally endeared himself to the Tea Party wing of the party, of his congressional delegation, by taking the stands he took in his last 4 or 5 weeks, which I thought was very interesting.
Well, you get in there with your troops and get bloodied, and there's a certain kind of, you know, bonding that takes place. I think the challenge for Obama is going to be on Obamacare in terms of getting the problem solved on that, getting it implemented as it should be, and getting adjustments or changes made to it that make it work better. And he's going to be subject to a lot of attack because people will be able to say, well, okay, you got your way. You went to the brink to get your way. Now how come it's not working?
Yeah, and there are problems galore that are being reported.
Although, to be clear, you know, in Washington State, you know, that website worked very well, and I think they already have like almost 30,000 people signed up.
That's right. It's not an issue anywhere, and a lot of the problems are at the state and local level. But I still think he's going to be on somewhat the political defensive on it because the mistakes will loom large. The advantage is I think Obamacare is going to be good for the country. So ultimately, I think it will work out. But I think it's a challenge for him.
Yeah, a lot of the problems were in states where the states refused to take the money or the assistance, and the federal government had to do it, and they were not quite up to doing all that without the partnership of the state.
Well, and I think that's one of the things I think Republicans are afraid of. It's not that they're going to fall in love with Obamacare, but that they're going to say, well, this works well enough. Why don't we just go the whole hog for single payer instead of having this patchwork?
All right. I'm going to pivot now to the local races and the mayor's race in particular. So, Essex, you did 2 in-depth interviews. Mike McGinn and Ed Murray, they're going to air Monday on a special at 7 on Cairo.
Cairo 7, our mayoral special, Seattle's Future, Your Choice. It's Monday at 7 o'clock. We had 2-hour-long interviews. We interviewed them separately. We talked with them about the issues that we've heard so much about in the race, but it also gave us an opportunity to do what you don't often get in the traditional debate and let them talk a little longer about themselves personally, what has influenced them, their political heroes. So it's a mix of both the issues and something that gives you some more insight into the personalities and what has shaped each candidate. And I learned things that I did not know about each one. Very interesting.
Is that right? Things that surprised you about either of them?
Yes. I did not know, and I was really surprised when Ed Murray mentioned that before going off to college, he took a year and he went to Northern Ireland. And remember, this was back when the Troubles were raging.
Right.
He went to Northern Ireland under a program that was set up by churches here, and it was a program to try to help bring peace to Northern Ireland. And he says that's one of the things that drives him today, that influences him today, because he saw how people who, you know, look alike and are related to each other, when they can't get together, these terrible things happen. So that's part of what drives him. Mike McGinn, I did not know. He had worked for Congressman Weaver in Oregon, Congressman Jim Weaver in Oregon. Congressman Weaver was one of the famous opponents of the nuclear plants that came to be known as WHOOPS. He was very lonely in that. Mike McGinn saw him stick with his lonely and ultimately right stand. And that helps inform the way that he sometimes seems to be alone. But if he feels he is right, he thinks people ought to know where he stands and he ought to stick by it.
That's interesting. Does it feel like it's – are we at a – I think I asked you guys this last week, but I'll ask again. Are we at that crossroads here? City could go in different directions? Or is it all about, as we've been hearing, you know, it's really about their attitudes in governance?
Yeah, I am having a hard time, and others here might know more. I'm having a hard time discerning the crossroads of different directions. You know, the big thing Seattle has to worry about is maintaining – its current level of prosperity. You know, you as a government, to the degree that government can, you know, needs to work with and support and build a prosperity that extends to everyone. Different directions, I don't know that there's anything dramatically different.
I think every election is a crossroads. I think that you can't predict what is going to happen in the future, and so it matters very much who you pick to lead you. And there are differences between the candidates, although the strategy, at least on Ed Murray's part, has been to not really allow for much traction on policy differences. We've talked a lot on this show mm-hmm. about the sense that Murray hasn't put forward much of a detailed policy platform or has been slow to do so. And that's part of why we endorsed McGinn. The Stranger has its endorsement issue out this week, and we felt that he won. Even though he's been criticized for 4 years straight, essentially, for not being a good manager, for being divisive and so on, he is providing over a city that, as Essex said, is doing well economically, that has weathered the recession better than almost every other city in the United States, that is moving forward on things that Seattleites seem to find important. And for the Stranger, Mike McGinn's emphasis on transportation, on rapid transit, mass transit, and yes, on bike infrastructure is something that we really liked.
Crossroads, real quick, and then I'll come back to it after the
break.
Yeah,
I felt that this election, that so much is going to happen in the next 4 years in terms of these huge mega projects coming online with light rail, with the transformation of the waterfront, the downtown tunnel, the Yesler Terrace remake, the 520 bridge. I mean, if you the comp plan is supposed to be redone in 2015, which is supposedly, you know, our roadmap that we're supposed to follow. There are so many things already in the pipeline that are already coming together. The arena is another thing. That I think the next mayor has to be somebody who can integrate that and advocate for the city's needs in that in such a way that when it's all done, the city still makes sense. It's not just a tangled, you know, mega project spaghetti that doesn't integrate. And the mayor can play a key role in that, determining the west side of 520 and what that looks like. That's critical. Issues about rail. Transit of all kinds. Those things are critical. So I think it's a really important time.
Let me take a break, and then we'll come back. We'll follow up on this. We'll also talk about the council races in Seattle and Bellevue as well. Essex Porter is here. His interviews with Mike McGinn and Ed Murray airing Monday at 7 on Cairo 7 TV. Eli Sanders is here, associate editor of The Stranger, and Knut Berger is here, writes at Crosscut.
Support for KUOW comes from the attorneys of Foster Pepper, providing legal counsel on employment and labor issues to employers throughout the region, online at foster.com and on Twitter. When it happens, Foster Pepper is there.
Foggy and 48 degrees in Seattle. Expecting the sun this afternoon with a high today in the low 60s.
Support for KUOW comes from Art Center College of Design in Pasadena, California, offering art and design education for more than 80 years. On October 26th, alumni and representatives will discuss careers in the visual arts and starting a creative journey. 2 p.m. at Verite Studios. More at artcenter.edu/Seattle.
I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:42, and KUOW's fall membership drive came to an end almost exactly an hour ago. We raised $1.1 million thanks to the contributions from listeners like you. Thanks so much for joining KUOW in this endeavor. Didn't get a chance to pledge yet? No problem. Just go online, kuow.org.
You're listening to The Week in Review on KUOW Seattle. I'm Steve Scher, Knut Berger, Eli Sanders, Essex Porter here, talking about what happened in the week in the nation, in the region, and in our area. We were touching on the Seattle mayor race. I just, because this is, I guess, a way to get to this question. You wrote an article, Knut, about manufacturing jobs and what was going to happen in the port and in the industrial zone. And Peter Steinbrück endorsed Ed Murray after he got a white paper out that was, people say, was probably written by Peter Steinbrück, endorsing a different policy, I guess, than we would say McGinn has been following for manufacturing jobs. How critical, or how much do you think a mayor can influence that aspect of the economy, keeping or allowing manufacturing jobs in these different parts of the city? SoDo,
yeah.
Ballard.
American have a huge influence. There are larger macroeconomic issues. I mean, the port, for example, is dealing with competition around the globe and a new Panama Canal. I was talking with somebody in the maritime industry who said anybody who tells you that they know where the maritime industry will be in 3 years is lying. Nobody knows. None of us know. So there are those issues that are out of our control. But there are a lot of issues that are in our control, particularly in terms of zoning, in terms of transportation infrastructure, in terms of how things are integrated into a master plan. We do have industrial districts. Peter Steinbrück made that a centerpiece of his campaign. He kicked his campaign off at Fisherman's Terminal, et cetera. He was an opponent of the SoDo Arena because a lot of people, including the port and the Longshoremen's Union and others, believe that that is going to be kind of the straw that breaks the camel's back in terms of free flowing of freight and whatnot. So it's a critical issue. Peter made it key to whether he was going to endorse in the race or not. And, you know, I think he was satisfied that Murray is at least willing to discuss that stuff. The port is very alienated from Mike McGinn, the Port of Seattle is, and some of the unions down in the maritime industrial area. Not all the unions. He got an endorsement just this morning from the professional and technical union workers. So, but I think the mayor can have a lot of influence, and I think relationships is part of that and vision is part of that. Or is it a basketball arena or is it family wage longshore jobs?
What do you make of the fact that McGinn does get the endorsement of I'm blanking on the name, though, but it's sort of the Ballard industrial folks, Eugene Wathurman and his group. I was surprised to see him there, but McGinn has their endorsement, and they have some of the very same issues as the port.
Yeah, it's interesting. It can come down to the fact that whether the mayor has been responsive or not to a particular issue in a particular place. And the unions in this town are divided. I mean, there's union support on both sides. I think that the port is driving a lot of this because of their macro concerns. And some people think, you know, that they're a little overboard on that, that they see kind of an apocalypse around every corner. you know, and other people say that one of the things you hear is that there needs to be better regional planning. And one of the things I was reported on this week was the fact that there are key members of the city council, Sally Bagshaw, for example, who voted for the arena deal, who want to reopen it. And in terms of having a regional discussion about the future of the port. And what happens where in the sort of broader Puget Sound region, and Richard Conlon and others are very interested in that too.
You know, in the Stranger's endorsement of Mike McGinn, you guys took Ed Murray to task for being what you said was basically focused on and interested in downtown business interests. What do you say when people look at Mike McGinn and say, well, he was focused and interested in getting this arena deal passed, some people said, at the expense of manufacturing business.
Well, those are two different factions of what you might call downtown business interests. We're talking about the Downtown Seattle Association, the people who have been railing against McGinn about crime when, you know, when you look at the numbers, crime is not actually up in the manner that they've said it's been. That's what we're talking about, those downtown business interests. I think that we have explored quite a bit this question of how the arena might interact with the port, which we see, or at least I see, as a kind of separate group of downtown business interests. And we basically supported McGinn's position on that, which was support for the arena and for the idea that you can have both. It's not a mutually exclusive proposition. You know, another thing that we did in our endorsement issue that's out this week is we looked at every single port commission race. People talk a lot about the port. There's a lot of pans to the port about, you know, how important it is, the billions of dollars it puts into our economy. Everyone who has property pays property taxes that support the port and pay the salary of the port commissioners. But hardly anyone pays attention to these port commission races, one of which, by the way, features Governor Greg Ward's daughter, Courtney Gregoire. So we have looked at the port races and we have made endorsements in all four of them that people are going to be asked to weigh in on this year. And I encourage people to actually read these. There's also very evocative imagery.
Yes,
that I can't quite recreate on the air, but I think will be rewarding to people who find the port races pretty dull.
Crisco is evoked. You guys had a good time writing that. In the legislature, the Angel Schlicker race, what's going to happen there? You have any sense, Skip? Have you looked at enough to predict? Because there could be a change.
I've looked at it a little bit. I mean,
control a little
Jan
bit.
Jan Angel did much better in the primary than Schlicker in terms of percentage of the vote. She's in the House. She's been elected in that district both as a Kitsap County Commissioner, but also went to the House in Olympia. You know, Schlicker is the incumbent in the sense that he was appointed to the seat when Kilmer became congressman, and he's not a political. You know, he doesn't have a lot of political experience. He's kind of a moderate Democrat, but he's kind of a phenomenon. I mean, he's both a lawyer and a doctor. He's got two degrees that most people would be satisfied with one.
And he had them, I think, before the age of 25.
Yeah, apparently he actually went to law school to kill time because he was too young at 17 to get into medical school. So he went to wow. He went to law school, graduated, and then became a doctor.
There are incredible characters in this race. I've started seeing it as Doogie Howser versus Blanche DuBois.
The most expensive Senate race ever.
Well, it is. I mean, they've got literally millions of dollars flowing into a legislative race, and it's because at some point this may determine the balance of power in the Senate. The Democrats want to get back their majority. The Republicans want to get their majority. They don't necessarily want to have to rely on the two apostate Democrats who flipped into the coalition. And so there's going to be a fight in every potential swing district this year and next year to determine what the ultimate outcome there will be. They would love to pick up that seat. I think Chris Vance said if the Republicans want to get the majority, they have to have that seat.
You know, last week we talked to Luke Burbank and he said he was going to rename his podcast Scrunch Point.
Feminist Moment.
And then Feminist Moment was another one, yes. And this week he's in L.A. because the man, he just can't keep his fingers out of the media. And I don't know, Luke, how about Apostates? That would be a good name for a podcast.
Definitely. I'm starting that this afternoon. I wanted to make fun of you guys for talking about the Jan Angel Nathan Schlicker race, but then Eli called it Doogie Howser versus Blanche DuBois, and I was totally hooked in.
Yeah. You want to pay attention to that now.
I do. I didn't know what was going on in the Washington State Senate or the would-be Washington State Senate, but now I am going to follow that race very carefully.
Why are you in L.A.?
Well, I have this side gig right now doing commentaries for CBS Sunday Morning because I'm trying to reach the over 90 demographic.
Hey, those of us who work at Channel 7 are a little insulted.
Oh, sorry, Essex. I thought it was Balter. I thought it was safe to make fun of CBS on this show today.
No way. He's counting.
So yeah, I'm down here. I have. It's actually kind of surreal because you come down to a place called Television City, where they shoot The Price is Right, and there's all and people from CSI are walking around the TV show. They're not actually investigating a crime there, and then in the back there's a little room where the news nerds hang out, and I go in that small back room and record these commentaries. But you have to come down to LA to actually do it, so it's kind of an adventure.
Why do they make you come to LA? You sit in front of a black screen.
You know, I don't know if it's teleprompter related, because what actually happens, this is not interesting to anybody on the show, but, you know, why start now?
Ba-boom.
Not the rest of the show, Steve. I'm talking about these segments that I'm doing. I think it's a teleprompter thing because there's somebody in New York that has to watch the teleprompter to make sure I'm doing it right, because that's where the show is actually based. And I don't know if they have the same hookup for Seattle or other cities, so you have to fly to a city that has a teleprompter hookup that they can watch.
Wow. That sounds like
that's
very
30 seconds
old.
Of your life you'll never get back, listeners. I'm sorry about that.
That sounds like very old connections, Essex.
Gosh, no wonder network news costs so much money to produce.
I know. Actually, you know what, Essex? I have that thought every time I'm down here because they keep talking about, you know, it's not like it used to be. And I'm thinking, how did it used to be? Because this is still pretty expensive and fancy.
Hey, Luke, are there Chick-fil-A's in Los Angeles?
I believe there are. But the big chicken place down here is Kookaroo.
Crew?
That's where you want to go, and they also don't have the problematic relationship with gay people. So you can eat the chicken guilt free at Kookaroo in Los Angeles, which is why that's where I go.
Yeah, Essex Porter, you've been following this story.
I have been following the
Chick-fil-A story,
and you know we did a poll to go along with our special on the mayor's race, and we put in some Chick-fil-A questions because Chick-fil-A is going to open, it seems, restaurants in Seattle. We want to know if anybody will eat there. I have the results from our exclusive Cairo 7 poll on Chick-fil-A.
Please.
All right, so will you eat?
This is why news costs so much.
Yeah, I was going to say, breaking.
I thought you were going to make us watch tonight. You're going to tell us on
TV. Yeah, tell us. But he's only going to tease us with it.
Don't yes. Give away your special,
no, I'm going to give the results. How many people eat at Chick-fil-A? 38% say yes. 47% say they will not eat at Chick-fil-A in Seattle. And I have the reasons people say they.
Yeah, don't. Yeah. What are they? And we should remember the mayors got right into this.
That's both of them.
Both of them. They said they weren't going to be supporting Chick-fil-A because they thought they had a terrible policy towards gays, right. A bigoted owner.
But here's the thing. Here's what you need to do if you happen to disagree with Chick-fil-A's policy. And I did not make this up or come up with this. This is our mutual friend, Steve, Andrew Walsh. His girlfriend came up with this, which is basically she loves Chick-fil-A. She's from the South. She doesn't agree with their politics. So every time she goes to Chick-fil-A, she donates the exact amount that she spent at Chick-fil-A to a pro-gay organization.
Oh, that's very interesting. Mm-hmm. So what do people say their reasons for not eating at Chick-fil-A?
All right. Disagree with the company's stand on social issues, 38%. Don't eat fast food, 30%. Now,
lying.
30% of the people
lying.
Don't eat fast food. I don't know about that. Some other reason, 26%, but only 4% don't like chicken.
Well, that's right. Nobody's going to be complaining about chicken. Well, I think you should go to a Chick-fil-A and then do that donation, Luke.
Yeah, okay, that's my plan. I'm going to start the podcast. What's it called? Apostate?
Yeah, apostates.
I'm going to start chicken apostates this afternoon. I'm going to go to a Chick-fil-A. Any other errands I need to run for you down there in Los Angeles?
What's on LiveWire tonight?
Oh, yeah, LiveWire, that radio show that I do that's on at 8 o'clock tonight. It's it's the Wordstock show, which only in public radio do you sell out a literary-themed show in Portland, but we did, and it was really fun. We had this guy Kevin Barry, who's a Irish writer, a woman named A.M. Holmes, who's a really great writer, and then a guy named Michael Hurst, who writes songs based on weird animals and recipes that Mario Batali cooks, literally the words to Mario Batali recipes. If that's not a sales pitch for listening tonight at 8 o'clock on KUOW, I don't know what is.
No, I'm already going to cook some Italian food and listen. All right, Luke, thank you.
Sure, thanks, guys.
Luke Burbank is a media conglomerate, TVTL. his podcast, he's also on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and hosts LiveWire. And apparently, Essex, gunning for your job with CBS commentaries on CBS Sunday Morning.
You know, I don't have somebody in New York working my teleprompter.
No, I bet you don't. We're just back down here in the lowly places while he's doing all that. All right, I just want to ask you one sort of silly question because I thought it was funny. Did you see the Onion's? Did you see the Onion's coverage of combination of what happened with our broken sewer pipe in University Village and how they took it to? They took it over to Congress. They thought that's where the broken sewer pipe is. It's just good to know that we can make news at University Village, don't you think? Any last words about any of these issues that we've touched on? Because I know we kind of got a little goofy there with some Chick-fil-A, but any thoughts about the election or what people should be paying attention to, other than tuning in Monday, 7, Cairo TV?
Right, and we will have the horse race results of our poll coming up this weekend. I'm not allowed to say what they are, but
Oh, you can give us the Chick-fil-A poll numbers.
Yes, I can give you the Chick-fil-A poll numbers, but I can tell you because what we are telling the audience in our promotional videos is that it is tighter than you think.
Oh, very interesting. Would that surprise you?
No.
That it's the no, really?
No, no.
Huh. I think we've all thought, and McGinn has certainly said that he hoped it would tighten up as we got closer to the election. I should just remind that the Strangers endorsement issue is on the streets now, along with our cheat sheet, which you can clip out and take with you to the voting booth, except
there is no
people
voting
don't
booth.
Go to voting booths or anything like them anymore, and so you can take it to your
bird
dining room table.
Any last thing, you take it to your birdcage. That's nice. Why media costs so much? Boom. You have any last thoughts other than...
No, that was it.
All right. Fair enough.
That's his endorsement of our endorsement issue.
People should read the endorsement issue because...
It's a pleasure.
It's very funny. It's very funny. You should not have had so much fun writing that about some of those races.
That is the only way I think that people can get through the meetings on the Port Commission.
Yes, absolutely.
And
yeah. Absolutely.
Knute Berger writes at Crosscut, Seattle Magazine. Eli Sanders at The Stranger, Essex Porter, senior political reporter for Cairo 7 News. And we heard from Luke Burbank, who's host of Live Wire. It's on KUW tonight at 8. Thank you all.
Thank you.
We'll talk to you later this afternoon on The Record.
Thank you.